peering around every corner, looking for spies and saboteurs, indulging and disseminating absurd conspiracy theories. For Trump's allies on Fox and the Republican Party have actually been repeating this nonsense, even though his own former national security official, Fiona Hill, debunked it during the impeachment testimony. And in an interview, Trump's former Homeland Security advisor, Tom Bossert, also said it had been debunked. And yet, on Sunday, GOP Senator John Kennedy repeated it anyway.
Senator Kennedy, who do you believe was responsible for hacking the DNC and Clinton campaign computers, their emails? Was it Russia or Ukraine?
I don't know, nor do you, nor do any of us. Ms. Hill.
Let me just interrupt to say the entire intelligence community says it was Russia.
Right, but it could also be Ukraine.
No, it can't. Literally, everyone who has studied this has said it can't. It was Russia. Could have been Ukraine. Could have been Russia. Could have been a swamp witch that turned me into a senator from a rooster. Good to be.
Senator Kennedy from Louisiana got on television with Chuck Todd, and he echoed word for word Russian propaganda. He cited things that were simply not true. He cited evidence in The Economist and other magazines that never occurred, echoing a Russian misinformation campaign. This man is a United States senator who swore an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States. He's doing the bidding of a hostile foreign power. We are in uncharted territory, and nobody should underestimate how profoundly dangerous it is.
I saw no evidence from our intelligence community, nor from the representatives today from the Department of State, that there is any evidence of any kind that suggests that Ukraine interfered in our elections. We have ample evidence that Russia interfered in our elections.
And then there's Rudy Giuliani at this very moment is under criminal investigation. In fact, today we learned that subpoenas have been issued seeking information on Giuliani's consulting business as part of a broad federal investigation into possible money laundering, obstruction of justice, and campaign finance violations. Over the weekend, Rudy was asked by Fox News if he was worried about getting indicted, and his reaction was very Rudy-esque.
Are you afraid, Mr. Mayor, that you could be indicted?
Oh, wow. How long have you known me, Ed?
I've known you several years.
You think I'm afraid?
I don't know.
You think I get afraid?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
I'm holding the, according to the Intelligence Committee's report, I'm holding newly released call logs of Rudy Giuliani in August with the White House and, interestingly, Katie, with the Office of Management and Budget. What does Rudy Giuliani, the personal attorney for the President of the United States, need to do with the Office of Management and Budget? Well, that goes to one of the central questions in this entire alleged plot, which is, was Rudy Giuliani illicitly involved in extorting a favor from the Ukrainians?
Why would he have any contact with OMB? And when you say OMB, I think about Bill Taylor having that video link conference call about the security aid and saying that there was somebody from OMB in the room off camera who said, we've been told by the chief of staff who was told by the president to withhold the security aid. Why would Rudy Giuliani, who is not a member of the government, is the president's personal attorney, is there any legitimate reason for him to be on the phone with an OMB official?
Well, I think you're asking exactly the right question. He doesn't have lines of authority.
The Trump administration officially put aid to Ukraine on hold the same day as his infamous call with the Ukrainian president. And he didn't release that aid until after he found out about the whistleblower complaint. And yet, 50% of Americans are still on the fence on this. How is that possible? Everyone knows what happened. There's not a single person involved in this, not in Congress, the White House, the media, who doesn't know Trump shook down Ukraine for political dirt. His chief of staff admitted it and said we should get over it. And yet the Democrats are still building a case like this is an episode of The Good Wife or something. We know who done it. It's the large orange man screaming at reporters on the White House lawn.
Extorting our allies, denying climate change, separating families, telling more than 13,000 lies in office, sucking up to dictators, validating Nazis, employing white supremacists, and tearing the fabric of our democracy apart. This Thanksgiving, make time for Trump Wine.
President Trump withheld a White House meeting desperately sought by the Ukrainian government and critical U.S. military assistance to fight Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine. The president engaged in this course of conduct for the benefit of his own presidential reelection, to harm the election prospects of a political rival, and to influence our nation's upcoming presidential election to his advantage. And from the Republican report, quote, the evidence shows that President Trump holds a deep-seated, genuine, and reasonable skepticism of Ukraine due to its history of pervasive corruption. President's initial hesitation to meet with President Zelensky or to provide U.S. taxpayer-funded security assistance to Ukraine without thoughtful review is entirely prudent.
Usually we have something completely insane in this presidency, which is an argument about facts, right? And we kind of all know that you can't argue about facts. You can argue about opinion, but you can't argue about facts. But here, throughout the impeachment hearings, we didn't actually have disagreement about facts. We have disagreement about interpretations. And in a sense, you know, that's a kind of improvement. It's not as insane as arguing about facts. But it's also...
It's harder to push back on.
Exactly.
Right?
It really creates a bubble. It really creates this, this sort of... film of interpretation that you cannot pierce.
What does this mean for Americans? Why should they care about what the president did vis-a-vis Ukraine? Why should they care indeed about Ukraine? First of all, this is not about Ukraine. This is about our democracy. This is about our national security. This is about whether the American people have a right to expect that the president of the United States is going to act in their interests, with their security in mind, and not for some illicit personal or political reason. So Americans should care deeply about whether the President of the United States is betraying their trust in him, betraying that oath that he took to the Constitution to protect our country and defend its institutions. So we should care about this. We must care about this. And if we don't care about this, we can darn well be assured the president will be back at it doing this all over again, because indeed he already has. First, there was the invitation to Russia to interfere in our last election. Hey, Russia, if you're listening, hack Hillary's emails, and indeed later that day they tried to do exactly that. But then there was the use of this official power to compel another country, Ukraine, to interfere in the 2020 election. And even after our investigation began, even after the impeachment inquiry began, there was President Donald Trump out on the White House lawn, once again making it abundantly clear that he wanted Ukraine to investigate the Bidens.
And the president tweeted and then retweeted himself, writing, "Breaking news, the president of Ukraine has just again announced that President Trump has done nothing wrong with respect to Ukraine and our interactions or calls. If the radical left Democrats were sane, which they are not, it would be case over." Well, thanks for solving the case, Agatha Christie. That is some argument. But the idea that Trump is innocent because the guy he shook down said so is ridiculous even for him. This is like if he tweeted, "Breaking news, kid whose lunch money I stole says he gave me his lunch money because he admired my fists." Case over.
The House Intelligence Committee releasing a report this afternoon, a report based on the testimony of more than a dozen witnesses to Donald Trump's conditioning of military aid in a White House meeting on investigations into the Bidens and a debunked conspiracy theory about 2016. From the committee's brand new report, quote, the impeachment inquiry has found that President Trump personally and acting through agents within and outside the U.S. government solicited the interference of a foreign government, Ukraine, to benefit his reelection. On the president using his office for personal gain, the report concludes, quote, the president engaged in this course of conduct for the benefit of his own presidential reelection, to harm the election prospects of a political rival, and to influence our nation's upcoming presidential election to his advantage. In doing so, the president placed his own personal and political interests above the national interests. The United States sought to undermine the integrity of the U.S. presidential election process and endangered U.S. national security.
The president of the United States tried to extort a foreign government to interfere with your next presidential election.
I'll make him an offer he can't refuse.
Seems clear that the president pushed an agenda which had the Ukrainians trying to do something against the president's political opponent. And while he pushed that agenda, he held up $391 million in aid. The congressman is free to say that that's not impeachable, and the Democrats are free to say it is impeachable. It's not black and white. In my view, it is clearly impeachable because it involves two potential crimes, the crime of bribery, which Congressman Buck just mentioned, which is defined as the failure to do an official act, release the $391 million until a favor comes your way, announce, not conduct an investigation, announce the existence of an investigation of Joe Biden. The other crime is asking for campaign aid from a foreign national. That is a crime in and of itself, just asking. They're free to say that that's not an impeachable offense, but they're not free to say it didn't happen because the evidence that it happened is overwhelming.
On Wednesday, the Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing they've titled The Impeachment Inquiry into President Donald J. Trump, Constitutional Grounds for Presidential Impeachment.
President Trump's conduct, as described in the testimony and evidence, clearly constitutes impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors under the Constitution. The words abuse of office are not mystical or magical. They are very clear. The abuse of office occurs when the president uses a feature of his power, the awesome power of his office, not to serve the interests of the American public, but to serve his personal, individual, partisan electoral interests. That is what the evidence before the House indicates.
Imagine living in a part of Louisiana or Texas that's prone to devastating hurricanes and flooding. What would you think if you lived there and your governor asked for a meeting with the president to discuss getting disaster aid that Congress has provided for? What would you think if that president said, I would like you to do us a favor. I'll meet with you and I'll send the disaster relief once you brand my opponent a criminal. Wouldn't you know in your gut that such a president had abused his office, that he betrayed the national interest, and that he was trying to corrupt the electoral process?
If Congress fails to impeach here, then the impeachment process has lost all meaning. And along with that, our Constitution's carefully crafted safeguards against the establishment of a king on American soil. And therefore, I stand with the Constitution, and I stand with the framers who were committed to ensure that no one is above the law.
Is there enough evidence here to charge President Trump with the high crime and misdemeanor of obstruction of Congress?
I think there's more than enough.
If the President of the United States attempts to abuse his office, that is a complete impeachable offense. The possibility that the president might get caught in the process of attempting to abuse his office and then not be able to pull it off does not undercut in any way the impeachability of the act.
Do President Trump's demands on Ukraine also establish the high crime of bribery?
Yes, they do.
Have you formed an opinion as to whether President Trump committed the impeachable offense of obstruction of justice?
Yes, I have. The Mueller report cites a number of facts that indicate the President of the United States obstructed justice, and that's an impeachable offense.
And people are laughing at us. All over the world, they're laughing at us. The whole world is laughing at us.
Everybody's laughing at us.
Believe me, folks, the world is laughing at us.
They're laughing at us.
They're laughing at us.
The world is laughing at us, folks.
They are laughing at us. They are laughing at us. Believe me. The world laughs at us.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
We're talking with Tom Ellis, who's a member of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District and also with the North American Mega Dams Resistance Alliance. Tom is going to be the guest speaker at an event tomorrow, Thursday night, December 5th at 7 p.m. at the Bethlehem Public Library, 451 Delaware Avenue, sponsored by the Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace. And he'll be talking on Canadian hydroelectricity imports, job, and climate chaos. Now, we did have Tom on a few months ago. The proposed Champlain Hudson Power Express is a 300-mile-long high-voltage submarine power cable linking 1 billion watts of Canadian-generated hydroelectricity to New York City. So, Tom, what's the problems with this proposal?
There's lots of problems with it. In my view, the major problem is that when the provincial governments of Quebec and Newfoundland construct hydroelectric stations, what they're doing is they're putting dikes along river valleys, and then they're building a dam at the outlet and a power station, and then they're flooding huge areas of land, and they're creating reservoirs. And what these reservoirs are doing is they're literally destroying the rivers in Canada. They're no longer free-flowing rivers. So that's one problem. They're building these power stations so that they can export electricity to New York and New England. Okay, so New York City Mayor de Blasio wants to bring the Champlain-Hudson Power electricity that would go from Quebec to New York City. He wants to bring that into New York City. And a problem with that is that if New York buys power from Canada, then New York has to pay for it, which means a lot of money will flow out of New York State every year to be exported to Canada, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. It would be much better to spend that money in New York State and keep it recirculating within New York State. A third problem with it is that a few hundred jobs would be created during the construction of this power line, and then maybe 25 or 30 jobs after it is built to maintain it. And this would be for a $3 billion minimum investment. So to get 25 jobs for $3 billion is more than $100 million per job. You know, that's an incredibly dumb way to spend money to generate jobs. We could spend billions of dollars on conservation, energy efficiency, solar, offshore wind, and geothermal, and we could put enormous numbers of people to work. So from a jobs perspective, the Champlain project is, in my opinion, very foolish. And then finally, there's other problems, too, is that when river valleys are flooded, the forests that are in the river can no longer pull carbon out of the environment, and the rotting vegetation releases methane into the water and into the air, which means that, contrary to the popular conception of these reservoir hydro stations, these are not helpful in combating climate change, but they're actually contributing to climate change.
Yeah, on that last point, I just read that recently where they said actually the methane that's emitted from these reservoirs for these dams are in fact equivalent to the construction of a coal plant or an oil plant, and I had not known that previously.
Yes, there's at least one study that says that if you were to construct two similar capacity facilities, one a reservoir hydro station and the other a coal-fired power plant, let's say each of them 500 million watts, you would get about the same amount of climate change problems from each of them. And another study shows that something like 4% of all human-caused climate gases are coming from these reservoir hydro stations around the world.
So where is, you mentioned that New York City's, I know they asked you to talk about putting money on the table to construct this, but where is the sort of the permit process to run this, you know, huge electric outlet, you know, through New York State, and what are the decision makers at this point?
That's a complicated question. The developer insists that they have all of the permits. However, there's still some disagreement about the exact route that it would take and how deep the cables would have to be under the Hudson River. The deeper the cables would have to be buried underneath the river, the more expensive it would be to build it. So there is like a, a nationwide or a regional tugboat association, which is very concerned that if there's a sudden fog on the river, they need to drop anchors, and they want to be certain that when they drop their anchors or when they pull them up that they don't snag these cable lines. So they're insisting if the line is going to go forward at all, that these cables need to be buried deep enough so that there's no possibility that they're going to snag them. So that's one problem that hasn't been resolved. Another problem is that the financing for the project hasn't been finalized yet, nor has the sale of all the power been finalized yet. And I think the Public Service Commission requires that most of the power has to be contracted before construction can begin. So there's still a lot of holdups. The project was proposed in 2010. It was initially supposed to be finished by now. Construction obviously isn't going to start this year, and it's not going to start next year. And so hopefully it'll never start.
Now, back when I was a younger man many, many years ago,
I remember.
I remember we had this fight over the James Bay Hydro, you know, Quebec project. So this is Hydro Quebec again. How does this sort of relate to what we fought, you know, was it 30, 35 years ago?
It's similar. I remember it wasn't quite 35 years ago. It was from about 1990 to 1994. Hydro Quebec was proposing to construct power stations on rivers more than 1,000 miles north of here that flow into the upper part of James Bay and the lower part of Hudson Bay. So they wanted to dam, dike, divert, and destroy six rivers, including the Great Whale River and the Little Whale River and four others. And they had two contracts with the New York Power Authority for $6 billion each. And we formed a coalition of New York, New England, and in Canada and elsewhere, people from around the world, to block this project, and we were successful. We got the contract. We got Governor Mario Cuomo to cancel the two contracts. He canceled one of them in 1991, the same weekend that Bill Hoyt died. He was an assemblyman from Buffalo who had taken a strong interest in opposition to this. And then we got the other one canceled in 1993, I think it was. And after that, Hydro-Québec basically abandoned the project. I mean, they're still on the drawing boards. They could always try them again someday, but we blocked them.
Okay, Tom, we have about a little over 2 minutes left. I understand that actually, you know, quite a bit of the renewable energy industry is also opposing this, the solar wind, because, as you said, better spend these $3 billion here in New York and create renewable energy here in New York rather than, you know, spend it up there in Canada.
Oh, yeah, and also it's a way of creating unionized jobs. There was a study about 5 years ago that said that more than 5,000 watts of solar electricity could be installed on the rooftops of buildings in New York City. Even if one-fifth of that was developed, that would be 1 billion watts of solar power. That would be as much power as the Chippy Line would provide. And by putting 1,000 megawatts or 1 billion watts of power on New York City rooftops, you would provide thousands of jobs for sheet metal workers, construction workers, roofers, electricians, plumbers, and laborers. And lots of people in New York City have never had a good job in their life. And this would be an opportunity for these people to get onto a career path. And maybe they could get into a union, they could learn some skills, and they could work for 20 or 30 years having a nice career in front of them. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, or part of my approach is let's put some people to work, especially poor people and people of color, many of whom have never had a good job in their life. You know, let's do the right thing.
So Tom Ellis is going to be speaking Thursday, December 5th at 7 p.m. Bethlehem Public Library, 451 Delaware Avenue. A little bit, just a minute to go. So how can people find out more information, and what can people do if they agree with you this shouldn't be built?
That's a good question. They can look on the website of the North American Mega Dam Resistance Alliance, NAMRA. So that's a coalition of people in New York, in New England, and in Canada, and we're fighting a lot of these power lines. There's one that's proposed to come through Maine. One in New Hampshire has been defeated, and this Chippy project, which would come down through New York. I think just become more informed and recognize that hydroelectricity is not always a good thing, that some of them with reservoirs are horrible, and to speak up to your elected officials about how we want to keep the wealth of New York in New York, and we want to put people to work on safe, renewable power here within New York State. So we need to get the knowledge, and then we need to get motivated and activated and present our agenda to public officials.
So that's been Tom Ellis. This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Yeah. This is Miles from Hudson. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre Hudson Catskill.
Honey, did you know the Roelof Janssen Community Library serves Ankrum, Copaic, and Hillsdale?
As a matter of fact, I did know that. Ask me another.
Did you know that the Rojan Library has thousands of books, audiobooks, DVDs, and music CDs you can enjoy for free?
Yep, I knew that too.
Did you know that the Rojan Library puts on dozens of special programs like concerts and lectures, story time for kids, and seminars on computer skills and estate planning?
Uh-huh.
Well, Smarty Pants, is there anything about the Rojan Library you don't know?
Yeah, how do they get all that great stuff done with just 3 employees?
It's all about the volunteers. The library depends on volunteers for everything from working the circulation desk to staffing special events. They can always use more help.
Sounds like fun. How can I become a volunteer?
Just go to the library's website at rojanlibrary.org and click on the volunteer tab.
Hey, I knew that.
Sure you did.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Rodney Shop in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance, Broadcast Surveillance, Transmission Art, and more Saturdays on WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio.
...2019's Right Livelihood Laureates shine a bright light in dark days. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan in Stockholm, Sweden. Over 1,000 people packed into the historic Circus Arena in downtown Stockholm Wednesday night. It wasn't for the building's original purpose, an actual circus, or for a rock concert, which is one of its contemporary uses. What drew this remarkable cross-section of Swedish society, as well as people from around the world? Activism, courage, passion. Each year for the past 4 decades, in the short, dark days of December, people have gathered in Sweden's capital to celebrate change makers, whistleblowers, and resistance leaders, recipients of the Right Livelihood Award. The award recognizes 4 individuals or organizations to honor and support courageous people solving global problems. It's no accident that the award ceremony falls at about the same time as the Nobel Prizes. The Nobels recognize lifetime achievements in medicine, chemistry, physics, literature, economics, and peace.
The Nobel Foundation started a 6th Nobel Prize, the Prize in Economics, in 1969.
That's Ole van Oekschul. He's the executive director of the Right Livelihood Foundation, speaking on Democracy Now!
My uncle at the time, Jakob van Oekschul, to think if you can start new Nobel categories, it shouldn't just be a one in economics. There should be a Nobel Prize, which is still the world's most important award, also for people who work for the environment, and for the interest of the poor majority in the world.
This year's new Right Livelihood laureates are Aminatou Haidar of Western Sahara, Guo Jianmai of China, Davi Kopanawa and the Hutukara Yanomami Association of Brazil, and Sweden's own Greta Thunberg. Aminatou Haidar is an indigenous Sahrawi woman. Western Sahara is often called Africa's last colony, as it's been violently occupied by the Kingdom of Morocco since 1975. Haidar is one of the most prominent leaders of the nonviolent resistance to the Moroccan occupation and has defended human rights in Western Sahara for decades. For this, Morocco imprisoned and tortured her for years. Gua Jianmai was honored for her pioneering and persistent work in securing women's rights in China, the Right Livelihood Foundation said in its announcement earlier this year. She's the first public interest lawyer working in legal aid in China, with a strong focus on women's issues like domestic violence and equal pay for equal work. Her legal aid law office has been shut down by the Chinese government, and she was absent from the award ceremony.
She could not travel from China to attend the award presentation here in Stockholm. It's a sign of the shrinking space for civil society around the world. We've seen that in recent years with laureates from other countries as well. We're in constant contact with her, and we've agreed that we're not commenting on the exact reasons.
Oleva Nukshgul said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old climate activist who is actually from Stockholm, also missed the awards ceremony, but for very different reasons. Greta refuses to fly in airplanes because of the vast amounts of carbon emissions they spew into the atmosphere. In September, she traveled across the Atlantic in a zero-emission sailboat, arriving in New York City in time for the United Nations Climate Action Summit. There, she admonished world leaders.
You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering, people are dying, entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
Greta then crisscrossed the United States and Canada and was heading to Santiago, Chile, to attend the United Nations Climate Summit, known as COP25. When the Chilean president canceled the COP due to mass protests against austerity and inequality, it was moved to Madrid, Spain. Determined to make the summit, Greta then reversed course and set sail again back to Europe, making landfall near Lisbon, Portugal, Tuesday, the day before the Right Livelihood Award ceremony. This year's UN Climate Summit was moved not once but twice. Before it was scheduled for Chile, it had been slated for Brazil. After right-wing extremist Jair Bolsonaro won the presidency, one of his first acts in office was to cancel Brazil's role as host. He, like U.S. President Donald Trump, calls climate change a hoax. The fourth and final of this year's Right Livelihood Award recipients is a leading defender of the Amazon from Brazil, Davi Kopanawa, along with the organization he co-founded, the Hutucara Yanomami Association. Davi said on Democracy Now!,
"The president of the United States, they exterminated our indigenous peoples who lived over there. He's doing just the same. He's repeating it. He wants to kill my people. He wants to get rid of the forest. He wants to destroy our health."
Aminatou Haidar, Gua Jianmai, Greta Thunberg, Davi Kopanawa, each truly pursues ethical living, a right livelihood. Their examples should guide us through these dark days. From Stockholm, Sweden, I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
was local drummer and composer Bobby Previtt playing with Charlie Hunter on the track Can You Hear Me, Tango Leader from the album Come In Red Dog, This Is Tango Leader. Here's All Hell Broke Loose from the same album.
Thank you.
That was Jazz Fi Sci from the David S. Ware Quartet. Here is that band's pianist, Matthew Shipp, with Guillermo Brown on drums. This is Telephone Popcorn.